joined by my special guest and darling sister, Sister Razia Shamili. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, my dear sister Zainab.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Really
absolute
honored.
Pleasure. Today's topic of discussion on Muslim Lady is plastic surgery.
These days, mm-hmm. I have witnessed men do plastic surgery to please women. If women were happy with the existing shape of a man, he would not bother go under so much hardships and money and this and that to change his figure, right? So he sees the need. He has come across the need to make some physical changes to himself, yep. to be more desirable, yep. more lovable, more romantic, and etc. Now, why?
Why are women demanding such a thing?
Did your mommy or did my mom or did my aunt or did the woman in my family demand this standard of physical attraction from their husbands
yes.
back then in the 20 years ago? I'm looking around my family and because people come from different cultures and different backgrounds. That's why
sure.
we have the first time I saw a man around me who has someone that I know who has done an operation was my cousin
mm-hmm.
who did nose job. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's about like 20 years ago. He wanted to get married.
Right.
Rhinoplasty, exactly. He wanted to get married and his wife wanted him to do a nose job. So he did it for her sake.
Nice.
Right? These days, my finding
mm-hmm.
was that...
Your personal finding?
My personal
mm-hmm.
findings. My father doesn't have a perfect face. Neither does my mom.
Mm.
But they never inquired any kind of plastic surgery from each other.
Mm.
Never,
beauty
ever.
Is in the eyes of the beholder.
Exactly. Or like my aunties from paternal, maternal, any of my families, my
from
relatives.
From another generation.
From the past 2 or 3 decades ago,
mm.
none of them had any form of plastic surgery and none of them were inquired or requested to do so. Women were happy with the present form and figure and physical.
Were they happy or did they not have the
they
choice?
Were happy, Zainab, because number one, beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. And number two, aesthetic standards vary from time to time.
That's natural. You can't hold it against any generation.
No, it's natural.
Like during the time of my grandfather, I know this because my dad told me. I never actually met my grandfather on from either side. But he said the beauty standard back then was, you know, chubby, fair women because it was a sign of their
health.
That they were affluent, and they were well-fed, that they were from wealthy,
and they could
able families.
Bring children.
And then there was a time where, you know, like...
Barbies came. Standards of beauty changed.
Yep.
And so anorexic women appeared, and a lot of these illnesses
eating
disorders and, you know, psychological disorders and depressions and this and that, and always feeling that you're not pretty enough, you're not beautiful enough. And always having the sense that my nose is like this, my skin is like that, my eyebrows, my eyes, my lips,
this
my
sort
chin.
Of insecurity has existed among women since forever.
No,
yes,
I don't
it
think.
Has since
like,
ancient Egypt.
Maybe ancient Egypt. They had their own cultures. I am so shocked that when I go around talking to people, I see many of them have done nose jobs. Like, they have changed most of the figures, like
Botox
into mm-hmm. their chins, into their nose, into their
cheeks
bones, yeah. everything. And this is something that has become prevalent, like, in every family, in every, maybe, I don't have the exact statistics, but as a person living in this society, out of every 10, I see, like, if back then, 30 or 4 decades ago, these days, out of 10, 3 or 4 people, I'm not talking about like very fashionable or stylish families, very normal families, 3 or 4 have done something with changing their faces.
Why do you think it's bad though?
It's not bad. I'm just saying
that. I mean,
that
if they can afford it, why not? If it makes them happier and they're not hurting themselves.
take the feedback from the people seeing these ladies who have done plastic changes to their... It's not called plastic surgery. It's called Botox injection.
Botox injections.
Or even plastic surgeries. They say that she looked like these women that I've seen, they looked beautiful prior to the surgeries. Mm. And they just need that I have to do it. That she really didn't need that rhinoplasty. She went after she did it. Most of the relatives, they were of the opinion that she looked prettier before the surgery.
Well, that's their opinion.
I'm saying that it's a matter of taste. It's a matter of me feeding this into your mind that if you do rhinoplasty, you're going to look more pretty. You're going to have more self-confidence. You're going to have less depression. Right? So
there is an undeniable problem where a lot of societies, especially those societies that are not necessarily third world, but not that I like using this term, but those that are heading toward like modernism, their beauty standards are very westernized. They've got that Anglo-Saxon idealism for what beauty should be. And, well, European people, a lot of them, a lot of those regions, they have smaller, more carved noses, and they have certain shaped lips and certain and more prominent jaw lines. And, okay, this is a problem, right? I agree with you. For us to compare ourselves with a totally different race, a totally different ethnicity from a totally different continent, and criticize our appearance for not looking like them, yeah, this is an official problem. And it stems from colonialism. It stems from capitalism. It stems from mass media and pop culture. And it should be dealt with.
Right. And by the way, according to the statistics, an increase of 446% in cosmetic procedures from 1997 to 2012 in America has been witnessed. So when you were saying in the beginning of the program, yeah, that these procedures were always existent in society, they were rare. Maybe not even 1%. I don't know. I shouldn't say any number or statistics. But even in the past couple of 7 years, the procedures have become 446% more. This is statistics. And 20 years ago, people were ashamed
to walk in
and say, I want to have like this plastic or cosmetic surgery procedure done on my face or my body. It was something that like people did not accept it freely. And it wasn't something prevalent. The reason why a lot of these women, young and old women, even like not elderly, but middle-aged women. I know like one of my mom's friends, she's in her 50s and she got her nose job done 2 years ago. It really depends on the phase in your life that you are in. Anyhow, so one of the solutions that these days, the Western world, because they have created this problem.
For sure.
That, you know, they are the models, like the Miss Beauty, Miss World.
Yeah, beauty pageants.
The beauty pageants. They offer you, they don't offer you, they dictate a kind of standard for girls to follow, to pursue in their life, right? And so if I'm not that tall, if my lips are not that size, if my chin
or my nose, my complexion,
whatever, my all parts of my body is not like hers,
chest
hips,
ratio,
legs, feet, everything, then I'm not pretty enough.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
So we've been discussing the topic of plastic surgery.
The solution is that recently they have come up with the idea of having models, which are, as you said, oversized models, plus sized. You show the reality of how you are. Or on Instagram, I've seen a lot of women who have given birth and they show their stretch marks.
Mm.
And they say...
Normalize it.
They're trying to normalize the deficiencies or, you know...
Let's just call them changes. Because that's what it is.
Men look at it as, you know...
No, I think we fuel it into the minds of the men to an extent. You know, if a woman stands in front of the mirror 10 times a day, and each 10 times she says a little out loud, oh my God, look at my belly. It's so poochy. Oh, look at my rolls. Oh my God, my legs. Oh my God, look at these stretch marks. I'm so ugly.
No.
She says this 10 times a day. The next day, the man is going to begin to believe it. But if the woman stands in front of the mirror and says, I'm so proud of what my body did for me this year, you know? Oh, look at these stretch marks. Finally, I'm in the mommy club. I'm in the stretchy club. Or, oh, looks like I picked up some weight. I ate well
this year. You're talking about an infallible husband.
No, sweetie. I'm talking about if we're going to say... My wife is 32 and she gave birth to two beautiful, healthy kids. Of course, their bodies are going to be different.
That would be a very understanding man.
No, that's a reasonable
man. Why do you think watching Instagram?
Yeah, if it goes through some sort of abnormal change to the point that her breasts are lopsided. Yes, I understand that. Even if she didn't have a husband, she would look weird in a dress.
No, Zainab, I disagree because, of course, their bodies are not the same as they used to be. And for them, that kind of shape is totally normal.
Okay, then that's their culture. See, there you said.
What?
You said the word normal.
Okay.
I said if it's abnormal, she's allowed to go
through
some
changes. Who defines normal?
This is
my culture.
Their culture.
Exactly. Instagram defines
it
for me.
They didn't have Instagram in that tie, in that tribe.
No, I'm saying that.
Norm. I disagree with that too. But that's all the time we have, unfortunately. This is definitely a topic we are going to have to discuss furthermore. And if you want to join in our discussion, make sure to tune in to future episodes of Muslim Lady. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, so Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Dark Review. Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing the Maribor Uprisings, directed by Maple Raza and Milton Gillen. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian and The Telegraph. And beside him is Maurice McLeod, who is a social commentator and director of Media Diversified. He is also the vice chair of social policy research organisation Race on the Agenda. Now, the Maribor Uprising shows how in the once prosperous industrial city of Maribor, which is Slovenia's second largest city, anger over political corruption turned into a revolt against the mayor, the violent police forces, and a corrupt political elite. This documentary places audiences in the midst of the uprising as crowds surround and ransack the city hall under a hailstorm of tear gas canisters. The Maribor Uprisings raises many questions faced by these events and by the uprisings elsewhere, from the Arab Spring through Paris to Black Lives Matter.
When we watched the images from the protests of the Arab Spring, Greece and Occupy, we were certain that nothing like that could happen here. That is, until they installed the new stationary radar system, which sent speeding tickets right to your home, 70,000 in the first weeks of operation. Then we found out that 90% of the proceeds went to a private contractor, not to our city. Then we learned the mayor had close ties to the private contractor. Then we heard he was running for the National Council, which would give him immunity from prosecution. Then we heard where this was happening, and we went there to stop it. Twice we went into the streets. Twice the police drove us away. Twice the news media, embedded behind police lines, portrayed us all as hooligans and criminals.
We formed a video collective because things looked very different on our side of the police lines. All the footage in this documentary is shot by people like me, people like you. I invite you to join us as we record a new uprising, the third uprising, organized on Facebook and called for tonight. You'll decide how you participate.
Will you stay here and film with the people fighting to hold the square? Or do you go to record those who are seeking safety further to the south?
First of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. So we're in this show, we're reviewing the theatrical version of the documentary. It was initially screened as an interactive film, which gave the audience a chance to make decisions throughout the film. And Mike, if I could start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. There are two different versions of this film. And I think the version that we saw is an imperfect version in that, you know, it has the rough edges that I would associate with activist and collective-derived filmmaking, the rough edges that I think the filmmakers would say authenticizes that the action.
Would you say that by the style of the filmmaking and
yeah,
that it was done with smartphones? And
exactly, yeah. It's shot on the fly and, you know, there's no sort of calculated camera movements, any of the sort of slickness that you would get with more commercially-minded documentary, I think. There's something missing in terms of what we actually get, in terms of what the protesters are protesting against, I think. We get mentioned very early on a certain amount of public money being spent on radar systems. Beyond that, there's a kind of generalized dissatisfaction and grumbling with the administration. So maybe that was all addressed in the interactive version. We didn't get those. What it has and what really is its strength is the sense of absolutely being caught up in the middle of something. And in the middle of something that I think is sort of quite localized. We've seen a lot of films about protest movements in the last few years, things like We Are Many about the Iraq War, the protests against that, The Square about the Arab Spring, Maidan, Ukraine. But they're all big, epic movies. This is much more localized. It feels like the kind of process that you and your friends could organize, mm-hmm. or that you and your friends could, you know, rock up to on a Saturday afternoon and participate in. And that's a strength of the film, I think.
So do you think this film serves as a valuable tool for audiences who haven't experienced the protest firsthand?
Yeah, I think so. I think this is one of the reasons why it exists in several forms. It's a very good point of entry, I think, for people who haven't necessarily been on many protests and maybe coming to a protest for the first time, but do feel they have got something to say and something to share. And it shows you all the avenues you can go down in the course of one afternoon or one evening's protest. Mm.
And Marie, sorry, if I could turn to you now. As someone who advocates for racial equality and justice, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I found it interesting. Like you say, it was very bitty, but that's its nature and that's how it should be. It very much felt like you were in the protest, and I thought we didn't get the full interactive side of things, but that really felt like you were making decisions and you were in amongst it. There were bits, like you say, there were bits missing for me. I would like to have known a little bit more. I think if it were made commercially or whatever, there'd been a bit more about the history, a bit more about how they got into that situation. And yes, you understood that there was corruption and that people were feeling aggrieved, but I felt there could have been a little bit more to show how they were to how they ended up in the protest, because one of the big points they made was that people didn't expect the police to behave so violently, that it was a prosperous city and people were kind of used to, since 1991, at the end of the Yugoslavia, they'd had their independence and freedom, they felt very empowered, and suddenly, well, maybe not suddenly, but as the corruption became more and more obvious, the protests grew and ended up pretty violent. I thought that was gathered quite well. So you felt very much like, well, why is this happening? And but maybe with a bit more background from before, you would have got that a bit more. I felt like that was missing a little bit. It's sort of you were plonked right into the middle of it, and it's like, okay. You know,
you're figuring things out for yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
That was intentional. Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely. Which I guess, if it were a real protest, you know, that's exactly what happens. You're like, well, do I want to go down there?
There's a lot of moral questions, and there's lots to grapple with. And I think perhaps the abstract and philosophical nature of the documentary is a credit to it, and that's the kind of questions it raises. So we really get the sense of desperation and the sense of urgency for their need and want for change in the country. And we also get the sense that nothing has changed for a really long time, and he even suggests that something more radical needs to be done. Mike, I know Maurice mentioned that there isn't a lot of political context, but is there something, there's a need for these people to drive out to the streets?
Yes, I mean, very early on there's a quote where one of the protesters says, you know, we detected this growing chasm between what we want and what the world around us is. And so the entire film becomes a sort of disquisition into, well, how do you fix that gap? How do you bridge that gap? And one of the ways is to look around at the people around you, and they start looking out to one another and making their own images. Now, the protests that we see here come at a very crucial time in Maribor's history. We learn that they've just been named European City of Culture. Mm-hmm. It's often the case that these big moments tend to sort of focus a lot of energy in this way. I was thinking sort of the run-up to the 2012 Olympics in London. There was a lot of unrest before that. There were protests before the 2016 Olympics in Rio. What we're dealing with here is a contrast between the official version of events, the image that the authorities want to show to the world, and what the people actually on the street are seeing in their day-to-day reality. And one of the ways you bridge that gap is by making your own images. And this is exactly, I think, what this film is doing. It's showing you the images, the reality, as seen by people on the streets who just weren't happy with the image the authorities were projecting outwards to the world.
And Maurice, would you agree with what Mike said? And do you think there's universal aspects to this protest?
I think there are very universal aspects to the protest. I would add to what you're saying, in that this was the third protest, and as they said in the trailer, the other two protests had been, you know, filmed by the standard media, and they felt that they weren't representing what was actually going on. So people took control and made their own media. That's great. That's the way forward. And the universality of that is that's what happens now in protest. It's no longer is it, well, let's see what the BBC are saying about, you know, our protest. People get on and do it themselves, and we have the ability now to do that. Maybe not as joined up as a documentary like this, but you know, most protests now, if I were watching a protest, I would go online and I'd watch someone who was there, and I rather than watching the sanitized version, or the version that we know is spun to some extent. So there's a lot in that. There's a lot in, let's get our own messages across. Let's film our own stuff. Let's show our own images and tell our own stories. That's universal, and that certainly came across, I thought.
Well, that's a really good point.
I knew that people went into the streets in Cairo, Athens, Paris and Ferguson for such different reasons. But when I watch their footage, it still reminds me of our experience. I mean, in each city, it was the reaction of the police that turned protests into uprisings.
And Mike, what can you tell us about the way the police are portrayed?
Well, it, for all the sort of rough edges of the film, in many ways it's a very classical three-act narrative. So the first act is getting people out on the streets. The second act is what then happens once all these people are out on the streets. How do you control that mass of people? And there's, very early on, a fear amongst the protesters that there might be some kind of violent action. Mm-hmm. I was surprised, actually, that there are one or two clips where you actually see the policemen liaising with the protesters and coming over to protesters and saying, can you just tone it down a bit? Which, you know, I think if a film was determined to demonise the police force, they wouldn't have those little clips in. But at the same time, we do see a good deal of violent action like that. And as the narrative says, you know, these are the actions that turn a protest into an uprising and have this sort of violent reaction. So I think it achieves a balance. You do get a sense of, you know, the immense amount of fear on both sides, I think, once huge amounts of people take to the streets.
Mm-hmm. And Maurice, but I was getting this impression that the filmmakers had a sense of betrayal and shock by the police force. Mm-hmm. They expected them to be the people's protector, but then they suddenly turned on them and suppressed their voices. What did you make of this?
Yeah, there was a very specific moment, wasn't it, where the narrator says that they came under attack and it surprised them that they reacted exactly the same as the other protesters and started defending themselves. And she talks about love and the barricades. And, you know, you look at the person next to you, if they, you know, you're being pelted with tear gas or whatever, and they pick up a tear gas and throw it back, it's a very natural thing. You feel very, you know, connected mm-hmm. to the people next to you. And that really came across. It didn't feel at all, and I don't think it needs to, it didn't feel like an objective view of what was going on. It was like, this is from inside, this is what we're seeing, and that really came across, I felt. But yeah, the police violence, I mean, as a lot of the people interviewed said, that's what really made this into a major protest, because it sounded like people were kind of disgruntled and were cross with the mayor, and then the police reacted in a very strong way, which shocked everyone, which made a counter reaction, which is often the case, isn't it? It's often, I mean, look at Catalonia or something, it's often the case that the way the authorities deal with what could be, you know, perfectly reasonable protests ends up sparking something quite bigger.
So we see this in lots of protests, mass protests, Black Lives Matter, the Arab Spring, etc. Mike, did you want to add something?
Well, there's a visual contrast in the film as well, because we're getting lots of different opinions from the protesters. They're a very diverse lot, whereas when we see the police, they're all there dressed alike, they're all in uniform, they're all lined up together, moving forward silently. They become this kind of anonymous threat. Mm-hmm. And that's a very sort of effective little tool in the middle, going on in the middle of the film.
It would have been nice, I thought, maybe in the interactive part this happens somewhere. It'd been nice to have seen more from the police, because there was a bit that I saw where a protester said to, was trying to converse with a police officer, he says, take your helmet off, come and talk to us.
I'd
like to have seen more of that, because those police surely work and live in the area. I'm always interested in what makes the authority figure, who's still a human, look at someone that they, you know, that they, one of their fellow citizens, and think, no, you're violent, and I'm going to hit you. How can we bridge that gap? I'd like to have seen more from the police side of things.
You mentioned violence. I want to touch on that issue, because I think one of the questions the film raises is this issue of peaceful, artful protest or versus violent protest. Where do you weigh in on this debate?
Yeah, so this is a constant thing, isn't it, to be honest? Whenever there's, you know, when Ferguson happens, it's like, well, they've got a right to protest, but they haven't got a right to throw anything. And I feel like in my work, I'm constantly defending people's right to protest, and sometimes those protests get carried away because emotions are high and, you know, actions and reactions, like we've just said. Mm-hmm. I can understand. I thought the film did it quite well when it asked the question. It didn't say, yeah, violence, of course this should happen. It said, what's the difference between this person and that person? You went that way and they went that way, and you know, they got caught up and threw a tear gas canister back and you didn't. So it tried to make a link, I think, between the protesters, whether they were violent or not violent. I thought that was kind of interesting. Quite a brave thing to do for a documentary.
No, very clever.
It opens them up to criticism, I would imagine.
So it's not black and white. It's a complex issue with different layers.
A few days after the third uprising, the one we helped film, Mayor Kangler resigned and a candidate associated with the protests was elected mayor. Across Slovenia, 50 other towns organized uprisings under the slogan Gotovisa, they're finished. The prime minister was swept up in a corruption scandal of his own, his coalition government collapsed, and he was voted out of power. So the initial demands of the uprisings were met, even exceeded.
So after all of that, it seems as though the protests didn't really work. Mike, are you convinced they had any impact?
Well, this is the surprise third act. We were talking about a three-act structure. Generally, these kind of protest movies end with some kind of flag-waving triumph, some sort of great note of hope that the audience can carry away with them. And what happens here is that the protesters meet their aims, but they do so in a way that they don't necessarily expect, and that's the big surprise of the film. So it's not this triumph, it is more of a sort of score draw that sort of they model through it. And what you get a sense of is the filmmakers trying to preserve everything that they've learnt in the course of the journey, in the course of the protest, so that future protesters can come out and see the film and have a sense of, well, you don't win every time. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you win in a way that you don't expect. Sometimes, you know, it's that old thing about life being the thing that happens when you're busy making plans. And this is absolutely reflected in the film.
Mm. And Maurice, what did you think of this sort of ending towards of the documentary?
I thought it was successful, even though, not much changed in the lives of the protesters. I mean, that's the thing that leaves you thinking, well, what was it for? But as they said, they achieved all of their goals. Mm-hmm. Maybe their goals were too short term, you know, changing the mayor and, you know, removing the radar cameras. And that
some of it seems a bit superficial, some of the changes, like a political reshuffle.
Yeah.
Do you think the film therefore has a wider message about lack of trust in the political establishment?
Oh, certainly. I mean, that was evident that you know, they, as the woman was saying there, they've replaced corrupt leaders with other corrupt leaders. But I felt that the documentary did mention this, that that's not the only point of the protest. It's also, it brought people together, it showed that they actually do have some agency and can affect change, even if it's only on a superficial level. Mm-hmm. There was someone talking about the community type changes that they felt had happened since the protest, that people felt more engaged with each other's lives and more involved. Someone's talking about family history that they started discussing since the protest. So I think that sort of stuff often gets ignored. You go, did you win or did you not win? You know, something just in coming together is important.
It's about, you know, I think we've been schooled to expect instant gratification. And I think one of the things that the film shows is that you can't have an easy win all the time. Sometimes it's a cumulative effect of small victories that build up to something that lasts, that's worthwhile. And I think that's the kind of victory that happens here.
Yeah. And what other kind of wider lessons can we learn from this documentary, do you think, on the act of protest? Especially at a time like now, this political climate where we see protests constantly.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure that I watched it thinking, what can I learn about protests? I don't know. I think it asks you questions. I think that's more what the documentary is. It says to you, what do you think about this? What do you think about violence? What do you think about this? What would make you uprise? Do you think this could happen in your... All those sorts of questions are really pertinent. I watched it and... It made me explore thoughts that I was already having about protests and stuff. Mm-hmm. That's all very good, and it made me think about it from, a context which I had no real connection to. I had no real connection to Maribor, and no real knowledge of their protests. So it was good looking at it from, you know, clearing out the emotion that maybe is in some of the protests that I do get involved in, like the Black Lives Matter stuff, clearing away some of that and going, okay, in this instance, this is how it happened. And like she said, I was amazed by how much it still felt very similar. It felt very familiar, and the reactions and the anger of the crowd, all of that is exactly the same. So I felt it did a very good job at getting that across. I don't feel like it was offering a judgment on protest. I don't feel like that was the point of it. I think it was more, I know, the anatomy of a protest, or, you know, it was more explaining how it developed and ended up.
That's really interesting. So it's open to interpretation and it's relative to everyone's experience. And Mike, final 30 seconds to you. Would you recommend this documentary?
Certainly. I mean, I would very much now like to go and do the interactive version so I could sort of negotiate my way through the situation as it developed and see how things changed and how it changed my opinion as well. But as a starting point, it's well worth seeing.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. Don't forget to leave a comment and your thoughts regarding our show. I've been Camila Shambayati.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulema's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
گاهی موقع ها آلودگی ها تومار رسوب میکنه خود چون نشون نمیده چون تو روزای عادی و معمولی
Sometimes we are so much drowned into the sins that we are incapable of witnessing our faults and shortcomings. The main reason is because we have an ordinary life without any test or tribulation. If we are tested properly, then we could see how the dirt and pollution of our souls are crystal clear.
البته اون کسی که خوب دقت تو خودش بکنه میتونه بفهمه همون روزای عادی هم میتونه بفهمه که حسوده
Of course there are some people who can see the impurities of their souls and minds and they take care of their deeds For instance they can recognize that they are arrogant jealous angry or greedy However if we are drowned so much into this world we can't easily discern our negative traits and day after day we become darker in our souls Therefore we must be careful about our deeds and do not let our sins to darken our souls and minds
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Wa salatu wa salamu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami.
A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. When it does come to expenditure, when it does come to spending, when it comes to anything else that we're doing as far as our financial obligations are concerned, we need to remember that one pivotal characteristic that we always need to have, and that is balance. Be happy with what we have. Be satisfied with what we have, because it really is never, never ending. You know, you could buy a little boat and then say, well, I'd rather have a larger boat, and then I'd rather have a yacht, and then I'd rather have that, and rather have that. And you know, you can get up to the stage where you can purchase $500 million boat, you know. But when does it stop? It won't stop, because that level of tama and greed is always going to be something pushed by shaitan. Unfortunately, it's a very important point here. Sometimes we mentally justify them as well. Well, you know, if it's my money, it's my halal, you know, I can treat myself to these things every once in a while. But at the end of the day, you know, is it really worth it? You know, are you contributing in a good way? Is it going to make you a better person? Yes, it will give you some kind of satisfaction when you look into the mirror. But that satisfaction won't last very long, you know. Unfortunately, we can see that that level of misery that these kind of people will always have, because they're always going to want more and seek more. As we said, that greed is also, of course, very dangerous, but stinginess is also very bad as well, you know, where a person doesn't spend anything. Bukhl, a bakhil person. As Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he says, al-bakhil alladhi ya'kul wa la yu'ti. Bakhil is someone who always wants, someone who always eats, but never feeds, never gives. Imam al-Askari salamullahi alayhi, Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam, in spending or in stingy spending or becoming bakhil, he says, لِلْإِقْتِصَادِ مِقْدَارًا, for you to be a muqtasid, for you to be financially responsible, for you to economize. Someone who economizes is very important. فَمَا زَادَ عَلَيْهِ فَهُوَ بُخْلٌ, anything beyond being economic is a level of stinginess, a level of بُخْل. لَيْسَ Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, لَيْسَتْ لِبَخِيلٍ رَاحَ. Subhanallah. A bakhil is never comfortable, always counting his or her money, always worried about losing the money, always scared about being put in a predicament where they're going to have to spend that money. And that's why Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says that money is never accumulated through except by two means. Illa an bukhlin aw haram, except through greed, through stinginess, or through haram means. Laysat li bakhilin raha, subhanallah. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, he says, al bakhilu ba'idun min Allah. Bakhil is far away from Allah. Wa ba'idun min al jannah. Far away from Jannah. Ba'idun min al nas. Even people hate a bakhil person. Far away from people. Qareebun min al nar. And close to hellfire.
Ayatollah Javadi Amoli, the author of the book Mafatih al Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
There are many lessons
of the book
by those prophets. And
eat, take some in your hand, and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Then we have the topic of Israf. And I've mentioned the topic of Israf before, and again, having that balance, not wasting what it is that you have. Yes, you can afford to buy a large plate of food and only eat one third of it, but the rest goes to waste. That's haram. Being careless about what it is that you are buying. You know, unfortunately, some people, especially when it comes to food, I'd like to speak about that. Especially when it comes to the topic of foods, people waste too much food. And that's israf. And that is really, really, really damaging spiritually, socially, morally. And you will be responsible, we will be responsible and accountable for every piece of food that we throw to waste. Imam Sadiq salamullahi alayhi, he says, Adna al-Israf, the least kind of Israf, the lowest level of Israf, Hiraqatu fadlil ina, is for you to throw away the remaining water that is in a container. Like, there's this level of water, well, I'm just going to throw it away. That itself is a form of israf. وَإِبْتِذَالُ ثَوْبِ الصَّوْنِ وَإِلْقَاءُ النَّوَى. And a second kind of israf, a second or the lowest kind of israf, is for you to spend too much on clothing, as far as expenditure is concerned, going after luxury items. Continuing us on with this, it's all, Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli mentions, it's all to do with you remembering fuqara, for you to remembering the underprivileged, and for you to always keep in mind that, you know, there will come a time where you're going to need these kind of things. Another thing is, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is going to block barakatus sama for you. You won't have that level of self-discipline, self-awareness, self-progress, self-excelling, because your one and only concern is for you to spend, especially on things that are not going to be on any kind of usage. Here, there is the hadith that Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli mentions, and that is su'ul tadbir, bad management, bad financial management. If you, for example, earn an income of 100 dinars a week, and your main focus is on buying a purse that costs 90 dinars, why? Why are you spending 90 dinars and leaving behind 10 dinars? If you earn 100 dinars a week, have good management. Say, well, I'm going to spend 40 dinars on, I'm just saying, using the word dinar, dirham, whatever currency that you're using. I'm going to spend 40 dinars on my house utilities, on bills and things like that. 20, 30 dinars on food and trips and things like that, and I'm going to save the rest. And that's a kind of good management. والحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream.
There was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
In the limelight.
Mask mandates are being lifted in many countries. Testing and surveillance have decreased, and traveling is recommencing widely. People are understandably exhausted and want to forget about the pandemic. This would be a grave mistake. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by William Rivers Pitt, journalist. This article is published under the heading, 100 million new COVID infections could be just month away. Here's more. Recently, The Lancet dropped an editorial titled COVID-19, The Next Phase and Beyond. It read, after living for more than 2 years with COVID-19, with over 6.2 million confirmed deaths, but probably many more, with an estimated 20 million excess deaths and over 510 million confirmed cases, the world is at a critical point. The Omicron wave, with its high transmissibility and milder course than previous variants, especially for people who are fully vaccinated and without comorbidities, is abating in many countries. Restrictions are being relaxed and people are slowly returning to pre-pandemic activities, including gatherings, office-based working, and cultural events. Mask mandates are being lifted in many countries. Testing and surveillance have decreased and traveling is recommencing widely. People are understandably exhausted and want to forget about the pandemic. This would be a grave mistake. Now is not the time to turn away from COVID-19 or rewrite history. It is time to vigorously engage, redouble efforts to end the acute phase of the pandemic in 2022 for all, and lay strong, sustainable foundations for a better future with clear accountabilities and honest acceptance of uncomfortable truth. That represents a full 50% increase in infections from 2 weeks ago. Although deaths and hospitalizations remain down, thankfully, the acute phase of infection has not ended. Yet, incredible short-sightedness in the U.S. has hamstrung testing to the point that Americans could very well be in the midst of a full-blown surge and not have any idea how bad it is or how bad it could get. That 70,000 number, thanks to the U.S. collapsed testing regime, is almost certainly a low estimate. Delta, then Omicron, then BA1, then BA2, then BA2.12.1, and now BA4 and BA5, all variants and subvariants from the original form, each inching closer to eviscerating the rapidly diminishing protections offered by multiple rounds of vaccine shots. Eric J. Topol, professor of molecular medicine at the Scripps Research, warns, the virus that brought us COVID-19 is now going through accelerated evolution. Our vaccines must do the same. Short vision, this vital funding appears prepared to go exactly as nowhere as the last White House request for COVID help. The Biden administration is preparing for the possibility that 100 million Americans, roughly 30% of the population, will get infected with the coronavirus this fall and winter, reports the New York Times, adding, the 100 million figure, which the official described as a median of what could be expected, also assumes a lack of federal resources if Congress does not approve any more money for tests, therapeutics, and vaccines, and that many vaccinated and previously infected people would become infected again. In November of 2020, Ori Friedman wrote for The Atlantic, the United States, with its diversified economy, cutting-edge scientific innovation, and numerous other resilience-oriented attributes, might have been expected to cope particularly well with a pandemic, but COVID-19 has exposed the U.S. vulnerabilities, all-encompassing political polarization, debilitating economic and healthcare inequality, a president who has downplayed the threat of the virus and rejected scientific guidance, and decades-long drive to optimize the economy and society for efficiency, not resilience, and a national creed of individualism, optimism, and exceptionalism that has rendered the U.S. resistant to learning from other countries. 17 months later, The Lancet